think one of the most important things you can do first is have to have a wide variety of plants. So like that's a diversity of plants. So you have trees, shrubs, herbaceous plants, you want bulbs. So you want all these different understories, and that will provide food, shelter, habitat for all wildlife.
Welcome to the Scotland Grows Show, the podcast where we celebrate Scottish gardening. I'm MT O'Donnell, editor and producer of Scotland Grows magazine, and your host for this adventure. We are delighted that this series of the Scotland Grows Show is sponsored by Roots, a subscription from National Trust for Scotland, which celebrates Scotland's flora in the form of a Roots pack sent to you every 6 weeks, containing Scottish seeds to grow at home, tips from expert National Trust gardeners, and stories and histories of the Scottish plants protected and cared for by the National Trust, thus helping both your garden and National Trust for Scotland's gardens thrive. Kirsty Wilson will be well known to many of you as a Beechgrove presenter, but her day job as herbaceous supervisor at the Royal Botanic Garden Edinburgh keeps her very busy, where she's responsible for the team looking after various areas in the garden, including the famous 165-metre-long herbaceous border, the Queen Mother's Memorial Garden and the Chinese Hillside, looking after the largest collection of Chinese plants outside China for conservation, education and scientific research. Kirsty's career has included working at Highgrove Gardens, a year at Longwood Gardens in Pennsylvania as part of an international training programme, and as glasshouse supervisor at St Andrews Botanic Garden. She's also completed a diploma in garden design from RBGE, winning gold for her first show garden, the Coffee Garden, at Gardening Scotland. Kirsty is a panellist on BBC Radio 4 Gardeners Question Time, and in 2021 she won the RHS Roy Lancaster Award. And as if that wasn't enough, she's planning an RBGE plant collecting expedition this September to Japan and has just published her first book, Planting with Nature, which is a practical, easy-to-use guide for anyone who wants to boost nature in their patch and make the world a little bit greener.
Kirsty, I'm delighted to welcome you to the Scotland Grows Show and very excited to hear all about your new book, Planting with Nature.
Thank you so much for inviting me, and it's great to be on the podcast.
So let's just dive straight in then to the book. So you've written your first book, Planting with Nature. What motivated you, given everything that you do, to want to write a book and specifically to write this book?
I think, well, I always wanted to sort of write a book, and I had this opportunity through work came through, and my main motivation was to save nature and how can I make the planet a bit more greener and better, and particularly when there are so many species in decline at the moment. And I felt that by reimagining how we plan and use our gardens, we can all do our bit to support local wildlife, improve our health and help tackle biodiversity loss and the climate crisis. Positive steps, no matter how small, could really sort of make a difference in our gardens and in the wider world. And this book is really a practical, easy to use guide for anyone who wants to boost nature in their patch and make the world a little greener. And it's illustrated and specially commissioned drawings by a good friend who also works at the Botanics. It's her first book too, and she's a horticulturist that works in the glasshouses, but also an artist as well. And it's great that we were able to capture the imagination of nectar-rich borders, native hedgerows, trees, wildflower meadows, how to create rain gardens, green roofs, and possibly a pond in your garden.
And how lovely to work with someone that you know and you work with on a daily basis, because so often authors then have to send their book off and it's illustrated by someone else.
Well, exactly. I was a bit worried at one point. They were saying, like, I love photography, and they'd sort of said, oh, maybe you can take all the pictures from the book. And I was sort of panicking, thinking, how am I going to make a compost bin or a leaf pile look attractive? And Hazel was just amazing, that and making it come alive with all the wildlife and the butterflies and the bees. So it's to really inspire people when they're reading the book too.
So before we dive into some of the ideas in the book and some of the practical things that people can do, I want to know how on earth you found time to write the book, given your schedule between your day job at the RBGE and filming for Beechgrove and all your other horticultural commitments and everything that you're involved in. How did you find the time or the discipline to write a book?
I suppose it was quite disciplined in that I did sort of say, right, I'm going to try and write it this day or set time to do it. But I felt really the main time I could do it was during the pandemic. And that's when obviously life slowed down a bit more. I couldn't go out and socialise as much and see friends as much. So I just decided that that was the opportunity to either film loads of Beechgrove or write a book. And that opened the window to do that. And I also felt there was a huge appreciation for nature at that time. There was a lot of uncertainty and there was a lot of, you know, being either on my allotment or in the lovely botanics and being so lucky to have that as my workplace at such a, you know, scary time in the world at that point.
Those subsequent lockdowns actually did have silver linings, didn't they? And particularly, I think, for green spaces and for appreciation of them.
Yeah, I certainly wouldn't like another lockdown to write another book. But I think, I suppose, winter is a more quieter time for me. And I suppose you just have to plan and then be disciplined to sort of get that book written.
Well, they say there's a book in everyone, so you've set the bar high. You've got your first one out.
Yeah. Well, it's not put me off yet.
So people who have heard of this book or who maybe have not heard of the book and want to know a wee bit more about it, it contains lots and lots of ideas and lots of advice, lots of research, lots of backgrounds. You talking about everything from planting nectar-rich borders, native hedgerows, you talk about wildflower meadows and trees, you talk about green roofs, creating rain gardens and ponds. So of everything that's in the book, did you have favourite chapters to research and write? Because everybody kind of has favourite things in the garden, don't they? Like pet projects and things. So were there things that you preferred to write about?
Yeah, I particularly loved them. Like I did my dissertation when I did my degree at the Botanics on meadows and annual meadows and perennial meadows. So that's something that I'm really passionate about and encouraging people to either grow an annual meadow in their garden, which comes up, like you would sow it just that year and it would then flower that summer, or you can put in a perennial one that comes after, like comes up year after year and is really good for biodiversity. And I think that was sort of like I already had a lot of background knowledge and interest in that. I particularly love to inspire that and bring the sort of the illustrations and the content on, because so many people ask, how do they create a meadow? Is that through sort of turf or putting in plug plants or sowing the seed? So that was great to explain that. And then another favorite was probably the rain garden piece, because I've been doing a lot of research. Like I helped design and plant a rain garden within the garden at work at the Botanics. And it was partnered with Heriot Watt University, and we've written a scientific paper on that. So again, a lot of background information and research and making that usable for someone in their own garden. So whether that's, you know, taking water off your downpipe and creating a rain garden, stopping flooding in your streets and, you know, not cementing and tarmacking over your front garden and actually using plants as a nature-based solution to absorb that extra water. So yes, certainly ones like that. And then, you know, I look after six ponds at work. So my team look after six ponds. So we're quite well aware of how to plant up a pond and whether it's a small one to a massive pond. And I think that's one of the best things you can do to actually attract wildlife into your garden is to put in a pond first. And you don't need a massive garden. You can actually start with a small container pond. I have a small one on my allotment, or you can have a big pond if you've got a much larger garden.
And what better things to write about for a Scottish audience than ponds and rain gardens? I mean, rain gardens in July, that's pretty much what we're facing at the moment.
I know, and I think with climate change, it's quite tricky because we're one minute we're either getting intense downpours or we're having a drought. And it's in the rain garden I've been studying at work, these plants have to be really adaptable because I don't water that rain garden, and we've like made the soil profile much more free draining and gritty with a gravel sort of mulch on the top, and these plants need to be able to cope with the drought and the wet. So I think going forward, a lot of understanding for climate change and how we can adapt our gardens is going to be really important research-wise.
And that is exactly the kind of practical advice that people want to hear, don't they, now moving forward, that how can we not just mitigate against climate change in general, but in our gardens, how can we do our bit? How can we buy plants which are drought tolerant for when we need them to be, but also hardy enough to survive? So the book contains lots of practical activities that would encourage readers in ways to make positive steps to make a difference in their planting. If you were talking now to a brand new gardener, someone who didn't garden at all, or someone who just wanted to garden in a way which was more friendly for wildlife, what would be the best kind of pieces of advice you would give to someone to get started now to garden and just in a more wildlife friendly way?
I think don't rush into it too much. As a garden designer, I think you need to step back and look at your space. And I think one of the most important things you can do first is to have a wide variety of plants. So like that's a diversity of plants. So have trees, shrubs, herbaceous plants, you want bulbs. So you want all these different understories, and that will provide food, shelter, habitat for all wildlife. If you only, you know, say you only have like a lawn, you're not going to get that much wildlife. Whereas if you put in that diversity of plants, and also remember to try and find flowers throughout the whole year. So have something flowering every month. And the best way to do that, as people always recommend, is to go to the garden centre once a month and pick what's in flower then. But remember things like pick flowers that are open and single flowered so that basically the bees can access the pollen and nectar. Don't go for anything too double and frilly and showy that's been overbred. Those flowers are no good for pollinators. It's also good to be like not too tidy in your garden. I don't cut down any of my herbaceous perennials to about January, February, and that allows the seed for the birds so they can, you know, take the seed and feed on that through the winter months. It also looks lovely in the frost for architectural interest, and then invertebrates or the bugs can then live in the stems too. Also, I would recommend, you know, making your own compost is one of the best things that you can do. There's a whole ecosystem there, and it starts with the small worms and invertebrates in the soil. And once you get that right, then you'll have more wildlife, and also your plants will be happier and healthier, and you won't have as many weeds, and you'll feed your whole garden. And then, you know, lastly, it's important to use no chemicals in your garden at all. You know, if you're spraying pesticide or weed killer, it's also bad for humans. And there's so many studies now, last year in The Guardian, about even bumblebee colonies can't regulate their temperature due to pesticide. So, you know, I was always trained as a horticulturist to use the chemical control as the last option. So always try and find that alternative. And nowadays there's so many biological controls out there, and many for the home gardener as well. You can even buy ladybirds now to eat your aphids. And sometimes it's just be patient. And if you see aphids on your roses, just wait, because ladybirds will appear. And it's that whole balanced ecosystem, because once you're organic, then you will see a lot more wildlife and bird life, and that will control your pests and diseases as well.
Great advice. People hear about these things all the time, don't they, in isolation, don't use chemicals, but very often then there's no alternative provided for that, or make your own compost, but how do we actually do that? So it's good in your book to get all these things together and have them there in a practical way so people can just work through. And I guess the best way is don't have to do everything all at once. Pick one thing and do it well.
Exactly. And I think that diversity of just having as many different types of plants, whether that's trees, shrubs, flowers, bulbs, all the understory, that just will provide an amazing habitat. And also it's quite important to remember your neighbours. So you might have a fence, or you know, it's really good to have a hedge, have corridors so that wildlife can move in between your garden and your neighbours. If there's just straight fencing and a hedgehog can get under that fence, it's not good for wildlife at all. Or if you have a fence, grow climbers up it. If you can put in a native hedge row, that's amazing for biodiversity and one of the best things you can do. But yeah, I think don't be put off. And I think just small steps, because there could be your neighbour down the street might have a lovely wildflower meadow and you might have more pollinator rich nectar flowers. And it's that mosaic of these gardens made up all the way through, you know, Scotland will benefit wildlife.
Great. And I actually just posted yesterday about my boring fences in my garden, which I have covered with hydrangea, lovely climbing hydrangea, the hydrangea pularis. So it's It does so much better in shade. And so the boring fences on the shady side of the garden look fabulous now because they're slow to get going. But once it gets going, wow, it just covers the fence and it's straight through the other side onto the road now. So everyone else gets to see the blooms now.
A wonderful plant. And like, you never know, before long, then you might have birds nesting in it as well. And you've got the flowers as well, which benefits pollinators too. So it's, you know, and that cover as well. And I think it's just that, just thinking like shelter, habitat, food, water, what do they need to survive?
So now that we're talking about plants, Kirsty, I'm going to put you on the spot. So with every guest across the podcast, I've asked the same question. And in asking them if they could only have three plants in a garden, what would they be and why? Now, I realise it's a very difficult question and nobody wants to have three plants in the garden, but it's the desert island discs thing, isn't it? So if you could only have three plants in your garden, what would you choose and why? It's so interesting. I can't wait to hear what you say.
I find it very hard to like narrow down what are my favourites because it can go for different styles and themes and how I'm feeling.
It's not like you're not surrounded with plants all day, every day. So, I mean, how do you choose from what you see in the botanics?
Well, exactly. And it goes with the seasons as well. I think I am spoiled because there's always something out or in flower and, you know, every year is sort of different or blooms can be different from year to year. But I would say I'm a bit of a sucker for Echinopsis and they do particularly well up here in Scotland, not so much down south in England, but that's the blue Himalayan poppy. And I'm actually on the Echinopsis Society as well here in Scotland, so I'm probably plugging that as well. But it's an amazing society and you can join it and you can find out a lot about growing Echinopsis. And, you know, they give you seed every year that you can then sow and have even more Echinopsis in your garden. And I think Echinopsis are so unique because they're that blue colour that you don't really see in nature. So when it flowers in sort of the middle of May, start of June, we have so many tourists and people just, you know, it's like blue poppy mania, just trying to see this plant. So originally they come from like the Himalayas and China. And they have sort of hairy leaves and then these beautiful big poppies and orange anthers in the centre. And Branklin has the National Collection in Perthshire. And it's definitely worth a visit, even if you just want to have a cup of tea looking over the amazing garden there. It's amazing to see the National Collection because everyone thinks Echinopsis are blue, but there are actually yellow forms, white, lilac. Some are monocarpic, which means they will flower and then they'll die after flowering. Many others are perennial, but so some are tricky, but the best one we grow at the botanics is one called Echinopsis sleeve donard, and you can split and divide that one and it'll bulk up. And they particularly like being in wooded areas. They like to be kept quite moist. They're very hungry, so I feed mine with a lot of chicken pellets and leaf mold every year, and they don't like to be baked too much in the summer. So not the easiest of things to probably start with and grow, but one I couldn't live without. My second top plant would be Cardiocrinum giganteum, the giant Himalayan lily, which can get up to like 1.5 meters tall. And if you're growing it from seed, it can take like 7 years. And it produces sometimes up to 20 to 30 white flowers, like trumpet flowers that are sweetly scented like a lily. It's the tallest lily in the world. And they have a lovely maroon sort of throat in the centre of the flowers. And I've been lucky enough to have seen that on an expedition in Yunnan, China, growing in the wild in its native habitat. And even in the autumn, it has these lovely big seed pods that form, and they sort of like flutter down into the area around it in the autumn. And I just, it's just the most amazing plant to grow. But once you get one, they do produce these little bulblets and you can like tear them off because they are monocarpic, so they do die after flowering. And if you move these little plantlets, then that's a new plant for the next few years to produce flowers. And they're just amazing in a woodland setting and the scent is incredible. So definitely an unusual woodland plant that I couldn't live without. So maybe I have to live in a woodland. It's sounding like I would love a woodland garden.
Himalayan woodland is where you need to be.
Yes, definitely. But then my last plant, I am herbaceous and I supervisor at the botanics and I love anything herbaceous and the colour. And right now in July, it's just peak season for anything herbaceous. And I would say Nepeta up here in Scotland, many people sort of want that lavender kind of look, but in Scotland, Nepeta does particularly well and can cope with our kind of wetter conditions if you live on the west. And it's aromatic. I don't know, cats love it, but bees particularly love it. I love the sound in the morning with it just absolutely covered in bees. And you can shear it down and it will come back and hopefully give you a second flush of flowers. And there's so many different Nepetas out there. The RHS has just done a trial. So I'm on the herbaceous committee for the RHS. And you can go online onto their website and see the Award of Garden Merit Nepeta trial and see all the ones that have won Award of Garden Merit, which means they're the best Nepeta to grow in your garden. You know, one I particularly grew at work is Six Hills Giant. And you know, there's many sort of large forms. I've got one on the allotment called Blue Dragon as well, but just amazing for pollinators. So that's one of the best things I could put in, I would say. And we've got a lovely display of Nepeta both in the herbaceous border at the botanics and in front of the botanics cottage. And at this time of year, it's just delight with bees and that lovely purple color against the stonework of the building.
So if your garden only had three plants in it, you would certainly have a real blast of colour through the season, because you would go from that gorgeous blue into those kind of Himalayan lily type muted colours and whites, and then into this massive
There it
blast
is.
of purple everywhere. So that would be a nice garden to sit in and very
I
wild.
could keep going month by month, but you know, if I have to just pick three, that would be it.
I know you sound a bit peeved there, if I have to just pick three, but yes, you have to. Everyone else has had to just pick three, and I had to do it too. So you've talked about growing a lot of those plants in the botanics. So you're the herbaceous supervisor in the botanics and involved in a lot of stuff there. And the Botanic Gardens is situated just outside Edinburgh, so you've got everything that you do there. And then you go further north and you garden in the Beechgrove Garden, which is set 7 miles west of Aberdeen, isn't it? On a Scottish hillside. So, what do you see as the biggest challenges and the opportunities of each situation when you're specifically looking at it for gardening for wildlife? Because you'll know as well from all of your travels around the world, people look at Scotland as one country and think that it's one country, one climate, but we're so diverse north to south and east to west and out to the islands, and everything from temperature and wind speed and, you know, the moisture in the soil. So you literally live that almost diversity, don't you, between two different locations?
Yeah, I would say Aberdeen is definitely colder. Many a filming day up there is definitely, it could be like 3 degrees cooler up there than it would be like 3 degrees warmer down there. But I would say I wouldn't be too limited by climate, but it's important to understand, particularly if you're designing your own garden for wildlife, is to see what works within your area, see what plants are thriving, visit gardens in your local area, and that'll give you a really good indicator of like what your soil type is, what your climate is like, and what plants are actually thriving there. But then many people will push the boundaries, and there's certain microclimates and pockets, and you can be quite clever with, you know, if you've got a sheltered garden with walls or hedging, you might plant a shelter. But people always say if you had a brand new site and say you had a field and it was completely open, it's really important to put in that shelter belt of trees and hedging that would help the planting that you're going to put in and establish. Between the two sites, I would say they're quite similar in some ways that, you know, both at Beechgrove and at the Botanics, they've got ponds, or there's a number of ponds at the Botanics, and the pond even up at Beechgrove is really large as well. And both of them, I see newts and frogs, tadpoles in them every year, which is really encouraging. Obviously, up in Aberdeen, there's a lot more snow, and the, you know, the season is shorter to grow vegetables and things, so that can be a challenge. But I think, you know, you can be clever with that and just sort of plan out your planting plan, and you know, watch the weather and things, and when you plant things out is probably the critical thing. For us, in terms of wildlife, it's amazing. Both at work, I can walk through the Chinese hillside in the morning and see the kingfisher perching on branches in the Chinese hillside, and then using the pond to d dive down into the fish. So even within an urban setting, it's amazing how much wildlife. You'd think that maybe Beechgrove might have more wildlife up north, but actually, I think once you plant and provide that habitat and the planting, wildlife comes. So many people have new gardens and they say, like, oh, I've not seen any wildlife yet. And then you're kind of like, well, have you put in trees? Have you put in shrubs? And just wait and, put in a bird feeder. And, eventually wildlife will find it if you provide the right environment for them. And I think, you can be benefiting pollinators just as much in the countryside as in the city. So wherever you are, even if you've got a balcony, you can help wildlife, whether that's putting out, a plant or a pond in a pot, or just some annuals that are going to benefit pollinators that summer.
It's the old adage, isn't it? Build it and they will come. No matter, that wasn't applicable when to wildlife when it was said, but it is build it and they will come and come them into the garden.
Absolutely.
So as well as filming for Beech Grove and writing your Planting with Nature book, which was just a small aside to everything else that you do, being on radio, doing Gardener's Question Time, your plant hunting expeditions. Tell us a wee bit then about what you do in your day-to-day job in the Royal Botanic Garden in Edinburgh. Because that really takes up the bulk of your day-to-day time.
Yeah, certainly that is like my core main job, and I start very early in the morning. So the garden opens at 10, but we have to be in there sort of 7:15 before any of the public come in, and we have to, do certain tasks. But I'm a manager at the botanics, and I have a team of experts who are horticulturalists who also are assisted with students and volunteers. So I manage them. And my team are responsible for the garden's herbaceous collection. So that's quite vast, everything from the Queen Mother's Memorial Garden to the herbaceous border to I oversee the demonstration garden. We look after the largest collection of plants outside China, six ponds, the biodiversity garden, and two native areas with native plants in it, the rain gardens. I could go on, but we do like plant trees and shrubs as well. So
It
some
makes
people
me feel
just
a wee bit inadequate having been out in the
think.
garden weeding for an hour there, thinking, oh, Percy's got a wee bit more to do.
But no, people always just think I'm deadheading the 165 meter herbaceous border, but really we do a lot in the garden, sort of except trees and alpine and the rock garden. So it definitely keeps us busy. So I have to make sure they're all happy. And then I could be doing talks or leading tours around the garden or redesigning areas or updating our database of plant records, taking photographs. It's quite varied and different every day, I would say. There's always something cropping up. I also teach the students on the degree course about herbaceous plants, and I'm allowed to research and things. So it's a pretty dream job. It's a wonderful place to work and a great team, but we work in all conditions all throughout the whole year in all weathers. And it's just keeping that team motivated. And we're so thankful to the big group of volunteers that we have in once a week. And they make a huge amount of difference and really help keep on top of all our areas.
So what about anyone who's inspired then by what you say about being in a dream job and working in the botanics? What if someone listening thought, I want to get into a career in horticulture, whether that's as a career changer or for those who are just coming out of school and starting on a career path, what advice would you offer to people looking to get into a career in horticulture?
I think it's quite a tricky one because you have to have both the academic of understanding horticulture and the plants, and as much plant knowledge as possible is really good, I would say. Is that when I was a student, you had to learn 25 a week, but it's also good to get as much practical knowledge as well. So, get out there in the garden, get your hands dirty, and know your plants, know what conditions they survive in. And I think, yeah, you can come into horticulture any level, any age, which is really nice. And there's so many different courses out there that you could do an RHS certificate, you could do a certificate in horticulture, you could go and do a full degree like I did, or you might just want to do a diploma. And actually, the Botanics does lots of online learning or degree programs or HND, HNC. And maybe if you're just getting into horticulture, there's a big event every year in about November called Grow Careers. And it's really good at promoting horticulture and the different areas that you can work in. And it's vast, like the different areas that you could go into. You could be people in my year sort of went on and became a plant taxonomist, whereas, many of us went on to be head gardeners or garden managers now. Others are, still horticulturalists, or they may be garden designers now. You could be a plant physiologist. You could be teaching about horticulture. You could be working in media. You could be on TV like I am. So you don't know where horticulture can sort of take you, but I think just getting as much plant knowledge and as much practical experience as well, and you'll do great. Sometimes volunteering is really important too, and I did that when I was younger, and that really helps, get jobs. And networking is so important too, and just getting to know people in the industry, ask questions. And I think I've always just looked up at people who were, higher up in different positions and things, or curators, and sort of said, well, how did you get to that position in your career, and how should I do it? Or, I had a fantastic opportunity at 25 to go to America and work in a garden abroad. And I think just take as many opportunities if you could. There's amazing grants for horticulturists to travel the world. So I think just take as many opportunities as you can.
You're going to have a queue shortly of people in the botanic saying, how did you get your job?
Well, if anyone wants to message me and ask any careers advice, I don't know, I'm still quite young in my career, even me, but I think I went straight in from school and I've loved it. And I think you've got to do something in life that you enjoy, don't you?
Yeah, and I think you're a very great advocate for the horticultural industry because, as you say, at a young age, you've already done so much in so many different and diverse fields and are still learning. Well, that's a good thing about it, isn't it? Horticulture, every day is a school day. We're constantly learning about new things and new cultivars and new situations. And obviously now we're faced with climate mitigation, so we're learning how to navigate through that.
And
Yeah.
you'll never know everything. Like, there's so many different techniques or different ways. I might prune differently to how George might prune his viburnum.
Well, we
There's
know
all
how George prunes, so don't.
he just lops it off. But I wouldn't be put off, and you'll never know everything. So I think just go for it and just ask questions and you'll have a great career, really.
And do you think those coming into gardening now, do you think we are now training the next generation of horticulturalists in biodiverse gardening, in climate mitigation? Do you think that at that level, an educational level, we're starting to permeate those coming through the systems?
Yeah, and certainly at work we're looking at a lot more how can we help with climate change in terms of designing green roofs, green walls, and how can we adapt rain gardens, how can we expand that out into the city and help people's well-being as well. And I think that is now taught as part of the teaching in certain parts of horticulture that you study, and I think that's really important going forward because all life depends on plants, and without them we have no oxygen, we're not on this planet, we all need nature, and it's going to be fundamental. So we're in an absolute critical job for the future going forward.
We are, and you just wish more people actually knew that. It's kind of like a fundamental basic of life.
Yeah, and I think even when I was younger, it was like not cool to say that you liked gardening, but I just still did it, and I didn't. And I think now perceptions changed, and the younger generation, like 10 years even under younger than me, are into it with house plants, and they understand the well-being of being out in nature. And I think this, what upsets me is, maybe some people don't have their own garden. I think we need to have more allotments or growing spaces for younger people in cities so that they can experience nature or just, grow their own food and things. Because, you have to have that connection. I think people are so much happier when they've got a garden,
Yeah.
really.
So I think everything you've said tells us how you feel about the future of Scottish horticulture. Take it, it excites you with what you see happening.
Yeah, I think it's really exciting. And having opportunities to see so many different gardens across the country. I love visiting gardens and getting inspiration. And I think the next generation coming through within horticulture, I think is really promising. And you can't get much better than either having our own garden or working within the industry. So hopefully successful years to come.
Oh, Kirsty, that is a fantastic way, isn't it, to finish, just to be excited about the future of horticulture in Scotland.
Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of the Scotland Grows Show. Don't forget to follow us on social media by searching for Scotland Grows across Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn, and sign up for our mailing list so you never miss an episode of the Scotland Grows Show. And if you are not yet subscribed to receive Scotland Grows magazine, 6 times a year, straight to your inbox, literally packed with Scottish gardening goodness, then be sure to do so as soon as possible, and you'll even get access to all the back issues. Details can be found on our website at scotlandgrowsmagazine.com, across our social media feeds, and in the show notes for each episode. The information on the National Trust for Scotland's Root subscription is also in the show notes, and they would appreciate your support to help National Trust for Scotland's gardens and designed landscapes thrive. I look forward to you joining me on the next episode of the Scotland Grows Show as we celebrate Scottish gardening.